Today we are going to listen to a recitation by Brother Wahid Nazarian. He was born in 1982 in Kermanshah, Islamic Republic of Iran. He began Quran recitation at the age of 15. At first, he listened to Sheikh Abdul Basit's recitation, and then he used Sheikh Mustafa Ismail's recitation to improve his knowledge of recitation of the Noble Quran. Brother Wahid Nazarian's main encouragers were his father, Abdul Hamid Nazarian, and his brother, Majid Nazarian. He has traveled to many countries, including Malaysia, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Lebanon, and Syria, to recite the Noble Quran. Now it's time to listen to the recitation of verses 71 to 75 of Surah Yasin, recited by Brother Wahid Nazarian. Let's enjoy it.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم أولم يروا أنا خلقنا لهم مما عملت أيدينا وذللناها لهم فمنها ركوبهم ومنها يأكلون ولهم فيها منافع ومشارب أفلا يشكرون واتخذوا من دون الله آلهة لعلهم واتخذوا من دون الله آلهة لعلهم ينصرون لا يستطيعون نصرهم وهم لهم جند
صدق الله العلي العظيم
كتاب الله
كتاب الله
كتاب الله.
Dear audience, you are still listening to the program Let's Recite the Quran from IRIB English Radio. What you just listened to was recitation of verses 71 to 75 of Surah Yasin, recited by Brother Wahid Nazarian. And now, Brother Muhammad, let's talk about this beautiful recitation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Okay, these are the final verses of Surah Yasin. Probably one page remains from this surah if you're using the Uthman Taha script of the Quran. And these verses, the first verse is about the cattle. Okay. And it says that they See they not that it is we who have created for them, among the things which our hands have fashioned, cattle which are under their dominion? So this is a question that Allah is asking us, that if we just see the cattle, there are so many signs of Allah in them. For example, the next verse says, وَذَلَّلْنَاهَا لَهُمْ, and that we have subjected them to their use, and they carry them, and they also eat them, and some they eat. So there are, for example, sheep, lamb, cows that we eat, and there are horses, donkeys, and camels that we ride. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Brother Vahid Nazarian, let's not talk about the other verses. Let's talk about, because we don't have much time.
Yes, of course.
Let's talk about
tajweed,
recitation and tajweed, the maqamat. Brother Vahid Nazarian, whose style of recitation is very similar to Sheikh Mustafa Ismail. Previously, he would recite the Quran exactly like Mustafa Ismail. But nowadays, he is reciting with the ada of Mustafa Ismail, but according to his own style of recitation, which is a combination of not only Mustafa Ismail's style, but the style of other reciters as well. And he has come up with his own, he has developed his own style of recitation, but still, we can notice that this style is influenced most by the style of Sheikh Mustafa Ismail.
And this is what ada means?
Ada means the type of articulation of the letters and the words and the phrases of the Quran.
So it means it is influenced?
Yes, it's definitely. Ada is exactly like Mustafa Ismail, the way of articulating. For example, if you say, أَوَلَمْ يَرَوْا أَنَّا خَلَقْنَا, see, this is a kind of ada. But if you say, أَوَلَمْ يَرَوْا أَنَّا, see, it's the issue of fasaha again. It comes to play. And Mustafa Ismail's fasaha is rather good. It's not very good like Abdul Basit, Minshawi, and some other reciters, but it's good. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, let's go over the rules of tajweed.
Good idea.
I want to talk about the word khalaqna, which has qalqala in the word qaf, in the letter qaf, excuse me. In the letter qaf, we have a sukun on top of it. And we have to apply something called qalqala, where the sound of the letter does not stay in the place of articulation of that letter. What does that mean? It means that right whenever you pronounce that letter, you release it quickly.
Mm-hmm.
You don't stop. You don't keep the articulators in the place of articulation of that letter.
Yeah, we apply, don't trap actually the
articulator. Yeah, we don't trap the sound. And if you say khalaqna, that's incorrect. Khalaqna.
Mm-hmm.
The articulators, they have to come apart right when they meet.
Yes.
Okay? This is the idea of qalqala. We have five letters that are letters of qalqala, and they are qutubi jed. They form five the letters. Sentence. Qutubi jed. Qaf, ta, ba, jim, and dal. Okay, for example, in the word qada or ahad, the dal is sakin. So the mechanism is the same for all five letters.
Yes.
But the place of articulation is different. For example, ba is, we have the upper and lower lip for ba. Yeah,
it's bilabial.
Yes. For qaf, we have the uvula and the soft palate. Okay. Or the back of the mouth.
And they all are plosives.
Yeah, they're all plosives. That's a good point you made. The letters of ghalghala are all plosives, and they're all voiced consonants. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yes.
Okay, now let's talk about one of the rules of Nun Sakina that we have in the first verse. As you know, Nun Sakina is pronounced differently depending on the letter that comes after the Nun Sakina. So, not all the time you would pronounce Nun Sakina in the same way.
Yes.
It all depends on the letter that's after the Nun Sakina. So here we have the letter Tha, which is a letter of Ikhfa. Ikhfa means concealment. It means that the Nun Sakina is not pronounced from its own place of articulation. It's pronounced from the place of articulation of the letter after it. And of course, when we say it's pronounced by the letter after it, we mean that it's nasalized. The only thing that remains of the Nun is the nasalization. Nasalization part of it. And what you have to do is that you have to approximate the place of articulation of the letter after the Nun Sakina. Approximation means making the articulator, such as the tongue, okay, such as the teeth, such as the lips, get close to the place of articulation of that letter of Ikhfa, really close, and they have to be kept in that position, which is very close to the place of articulation of that letter, and at the same time, you have to make a nasal sound for two vowel counts.
And after it, we pronounce the letter of Ikhfa.
Exactly. Okay, in practice, it would be like this. An'ama fahum. See, we bring the upper front teeth really, really close to the lower lip. Okay?
But we do not touch.
They don't touch. Okay? And even if they touch, it's very softly. Mm. You know, they touch it very softly. You don't say an'ama fahum. If you make it, you touch it
actually
with too much force,
mm-hmm,
or you actually place the teeth on the lower lip, then that's incorrect.
Thank you, Brother Muhammad, and thank you, dear audience of IRIB English Radio. That was the final part of the program, Let's Recite the Quran. If you have any comments, questions, or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. And don't forget to visit our website, that is parstoday.com. Please click on the tab Call of Islam, and there you can listen to this program as well as other programs of this radio. Until next time, we'll leave you in Allah's care. Have a nice time and goodbye. ذكر وموعظة ونور فيه شفاء للصدور وشفيعنا يوم النشور آياته تروي المدى وصفاته نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن ضياء يملأ الآفاق ونور يبعث الأشواق وفيه محاسن الأخلاق هو القرآن.
The Ocean of Dua. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we'll have a glance at Kumail's supplication and we'll discuss a commentary on that. We'll be back in a few seconds, so stay tuned. Allahumma inni ataqarrabu ilayka bi dhikrik
وأستشفع بك إلى نفسك وأسألك بجودك أن تدنيني من قربك وأن توزعني شكرك وأن تلهمني ذكرك اللهم إني أسألك سؤال خاضع متذلل خاشع أن تسامحني وترحمني وتجعلني بقسمك راضيا قانعا.
Dear listeners, as you have been previously with us, the part under discussion was this divine phrase of the Kumail supplication, where the commander of the believers, Imam Ali alayhi salam, says, Allahumma inni as'aluka su'al khadi'in mutadhallilin khashi'. O Allah, verily, I ask you with the asking of a submissive, abased, and lowly man, and to samihani, to show me forbearance, wa tarhamani, and to have mercy on me, وَتَجْعَلَنِي بِقِسْمِكَ رَاضِيًا قَانِعًا and to make me satisfied and content with your apportionment وَفِي جَمِيعِ الْأَحْوَالِ مُتَوَادِعًا and make me humble in every state. Imam Ali alayhi salam, in this part of the Kumail supplication, is humbly asking the Almighty Allah for requests, and he is hoping that he is about to reach the compliance of the Almighty Allah with his submission and humbleness. The four requests are Allah's forbearance towards him, the second is his mercy, the third is satisfaction, and the fourth is humbleness. Now, we were talking about the satisfaction request. We concluded that all the creatures that have been created have been provided with sustenance in accordance with their lifestyle and activities for acquiring sustenance. And we said how important it is for us to try to have endeavor for reaching sustenance.
Oh Allah, I seek to draw myself nearer to you through your invocation, and I pray to you to intercede on my behalf, and I beg you by your benevolence to draw me nearer to you and grant thankfulness towards you and inspire me to remember and to invoke you. Oh Allah, I ask you begging submissively, humbly and awe-strickenly, to treat me with clemency and mercy, and to make me pleased and content with what you have granted me, and cause me to be modest and unassuming in all circumstances. Oh Allah, I beg as one whose neediness is extreme, and who supplicates his knees to you, and whose desire for that which is with you has become great. Oh Allah, great is your kingdom, and exalted is your greatness. Your plan is secret, your authority is manifest, your might is victorious and subduing, and your power is prevalent throughout, and it is not possible to escape from your dominion. O Allah, apart from you, I do not find anyone able to pardon my sins, nor to conceal my shameful acts, nor do I have anyone except you to change my evil deeds into virtues.
One point needs to be mentioned, dear listeners, in this regard. Human sustenance is a reality that is provided on earth, and everyone has been set with a definite amount. As we touched upon this issue earlier, this definite amount is either extended or narrowed according to Almighty Allah's expedience. the extendedness of someone's sustenance does not imply that he is close to the Almighty Allah. It doesn't prove that he is a true servant. It does not imply his amiability before Almighty Allah. And nor does one's narrow sustenance mean that he is disfavored. Rather, the extension or the narrowing of the sustenance is Almighty Allah's test of gratitude for the rich and of patience for the poor. So the grateful and the patient servants would be rewarded in this way. The rich would also be rewarded by granting the poor, and the poor by maintaining faith and by being patient for the certain fate. Imam Hassan Mujtaba alayhi salam says in this regard, كَيْفَ يَكُونُ الْمُؤْمِنُ مُؤْمِنًا وَهُوَ يَسْخَطُ قِسْمَهُ وَيُحَقِّرُ مَنْزِلَتَهُ? How can a Muslim believer be discontent with his portion of sustenance? In fact, it could be said that in this part, Imam alayhi salam is referring to this part of the supplication Kumail. وَتَجْعَلَنِي بِقِسْمِكَ رَاضِيًا قَانِعًا. Make me satisfied and content with your apportionment. Anyway, Imam alayhi salam says, how can a Muslim believer be discontent with his portion of sustenance and considers his position low while the one who dominates all his endeavors is Allah? Wal hakimu alayhi Allah. The Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam asked Gabriel, what is the exposition of content? He answered, الراضي لا يسخط على سيده. The content servant does not take anger over his Lord. أصاب من الدنيا أم لم يصب. Whether he possesses something in the world or not. ولا يرضى لنفسه باليسير من العمل. And he is not content with his own trivial deeds. He's always in trying. He's always doing as much as he can. Because this is the true meaning of servitude. And because he knows that this religion has told him, اِرْضَ بِمَا قَسَمَ اللَّهُ لَكْ تَكُنْ غَنِيًّا. If you are content with Almighty Allah's sustenance, you would get needless. Thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us in this program. We'll continue to talk about this request and this part of the supplication more in the next program. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar. Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Shuma dar in qarn mojiza kardid, millat-e Iran millat-e mojiza asay qarn ast.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello, and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners of our program, The Man Who Changed the World, and of course, shaped all our tomorrows. I'm your expert host, Ijaz Hosseini, on this program, and we left off in our last program at the point where we were discussing about leadership and the importance of the uniqueness of the Shia leadership, particularly in the school of Ahlul Bayt, and that at various times, through the life and times of Imam Khomeini, of course, which is what this program is devoted to, is showing that in his early life, how Imam Khomeini supported the religious authorities of the time, especially in the holy city of Qom, where the Hawza system was established in the early 20th century. And we are looking at various aspects of what that unique leadership, especially the Shia leadership, what it actually means, what it does in terms of sometimes being passive, sometimes being active, depending on the circumstances in which that leadership found itself to be, according to the political oppression, if you like, at the time that was occurring during the constitutional movement in Iran, which was really hijacked by the British machinations of the time. And we are looking at aspects of this throughout this program, and hopefully we'll also touch upon Imam Khomeini, may God's blessings be upon him, his earlier scholarship as well, and how quickly he became a mujtahid of the time. So we'll look into those aspects as well. And I have the honor of having Sayyid Taqi Razvi from the Holy Seminaries in Qom to discuss all these various aspects and dimensions of the Holy Imam's life. Salam and hello and welcome to you, sir, once again on the program.
Alaykum salam. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being with us and giving us your valuable time. Now, sir, we were at the point, you know, as you mentioned, and very interestingly enough, that you took us to India in Lucknow, and you pointed out the fact that, you know, of course, when the British were, you know, expanding their empire in India and overthrowing the Mughal Empire at the time, how that was affecting Imam Khomeini's grandfather, who, you know, was a very active participant in the Hawzas of Lucknow, as you mentioned. And then you went on to the fact that how his grandfather left because of the difficult circumstances that, you know, the British were posing, you know, for the ulama, especially the Shia ulama in Lucknow. So if you'd like us to take us into that aspect, and then hopefully we'll go on to the, you know, the role of the various Shia leadership as we were discussing from Qom as well as in Tehran.
Yeah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I think briefly we touched on it, and whilst we're discussing the lineage of Imam Khomeini,
that's
we talked
right,
about
yes.
his lineage of his great-great-grandfather, who was known as Al-Hindi.
Al-Hindi, yes,
and,
yes, that's
originally,
right.
I mean, he said Ahmad Musavi Al-Hindi, he was known as. And he resided in Lucknow, and it was quite interesting that the reason for his migration for Lucknow is recorded by Imam Khomeini's brother, Ayatollah Pasandideh.
Yes,
that
yes.
it was not because he just wanted to up and go.
He moved
on to Kashmir. He, in fact, decided to move because of the expansions of the East Indian Company
The
British expansion in particularly this area of India, which was a dominant leadership there, was the Shia dynasty there, the Uday dynasty.
Right, the Uday dynasty.
And they were slowly, they had become subservient to the East Indian
British.
to this British right. East right. Indian Company.
Right.
Because slowly the East Indian Company was buying commissions into this this dynasty
right.
of the Odei family.
Right.
And eventually the history of this family is that they took up the whole of Lucknow and then exiled this the king of or the sultan of Odei to Calcutta.
Right.
Where he just finally resided there and did his last years of his life with his numerous wives and children and so on,
right.
left him in that kind of area of
right.
self-enjoyment
right.
rather than running and being
sure.
an authority.
And this is where your point is very, very important that, you know, as Ayatollah al-Hindi is going there for the simple purpose of the guidance of the Muslims on the time to make them understand what is going on. And, you know, how this is going to affect them in the long run.
Yeah.
Because, of course, the British, of course, you know, with their designs for India is to, you know, completely eradicate Muslim rule in India that had been established itself for 8 centuries.
Yeah.
And, you know, they want to, bit by bit, you know, take it apart. And they're going to start by, of course, attacking the clergy. You know, they're going to attack the very people who were the glue to keeping this together. So, you know, yeah.
So he decides that this British intrusion in Lucknow and the Muslim community
right.
was going to be detrimental, and he would not be able to have any type of impact within that kind of changing environment of
right.
the Nawabs and the Rajas all becoming subservient and slaves to the governor of Her Majesty the Queen Victoria type of
course.
Thing.
Of
so,
course.
You know, he could not take that as being as subserviency and subduing
right.
one's position.
Right.
So he up and left, and our history opens up to such a level that then we went down the track of introducing how he landed up in Khomein. But
yes.
what is interesting is this standing against the oppression, this innate bloodline
yes,
of the family.
Mm.
You know, we see Imam Khomeini's father himself becoming martyred by the gangster of the time in Iran, Khomein.
Yes.
And then you see Imam Khomeini himself, that an unhesitant confrontation with the evil.
That's right.
Being in his bloodstream, that even at the very basic age of 15, 16, he's identifying the enemies.
I mean, this is a quote that we get from Imam Khomeini, may God bless him, where he says that I am not going to allow myself or my adherents to become bullied by any other human being. You know, I mean, he makes it known right from the start that he's not going to be allowed to be bullied and is not going to allow himself to be oppressed by somebody else's wishes or desires, which, of course, are run against Sharia and run against Islam.
And you see, we see this as Imam Khomeini develops, that he is continuously eyeing the changes around him.
Yeah.
But as we said, he never confronted the leadership which is representing the Shia opinion at that time.
Of course.
There's a lovely ayat in the Quran, which is Surah Bani Israel,
right.
17th Surah, ayat number 71, which is very easy to remember, 1771, being the mirror of each other.
Right.
The ayat says, the day we shall summon every group of people with the Imam.
Imam.
So Imam Khomeini, from this ayat we can see that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has guaranteed this, that whatever opinion you have, that individual, if he's leading a people, he will be summoned on the Day of Judgment as the Imam of those people.
Sure.
And consequently, for example, Karl Marx will be summoned as the Imam of the communists.
Yes, absolutely.
And given the right beating for being so, you know, on the Day of Judgment.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, each individual... So, There's a double barrel responsibility.
That's
here.
Right, because that particular verse in the Quran refers to imams being either good or bad.
It will. That's the whole purpose.
Yeah, that's
that the people
purpose.
Would be called with their imams.
Mm.
So if you've taken on a bad imam, then the question arises: can you defend yourself in that situation?
Exactly.
On the Day of Judgment, you will be called with your imam.
Yeah.
You can't say at the doors, "Excuse me, but I was misled." You had
the
responsibility.
A bit
too late for that. But
yeah.
what also the fact that you had a defined responsibility to find he who is the right person.
Sure.
Imam Khomeini characterized this ayat's impression that he would take on the, he would go for the right identities, but when the imam is identified in front of him, he will toe the line.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is the unique aspect of Shia leadership, isn't it?
Indeed.
As opposed to any other school
indeed,
of thought.
Indeed, but in towing the line, it did not mean that you ignored what's happening around you.
No.
He was always observant what's happening around him,
sure.
to the extent that when the Shah was introducing various obnoxious political rulings, he firmly announced his opposition to it.
And we did mention that in the previous program in terms of the background that we were talking about. Although this was happening on the one hand, that we are talking about the migration of Imam Khomeini's family, may God bless him, you know, this very religious family, as you say, from a very pure line coming from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, from the seventh Holy Imam. We mentioned that. And we were looking at the aspect that, you know, at the same time, there were big, big changes happening in Iran in terms of its politics, in terms of its monarchical system that was here in Iran. And we were talking about the weakness of the Qajar dynasty. You know, we were talking about how the British, manipulated them and led them eventually to their downfall. And then we were talking about the constitutional movement, which was very important at the earlier 20th century, where this was a movement really to restore the rights of the people, because they were oppressed under the previous system. Indeed. But again, the British, through tricks and through ruse, because the clergy supported the constitutional movement in the respect that, you know, the rights that were taken away from the people could be restored to them. But through, again, the devil trickery of the British, they hijacked that constitutional movement, pretty much what we are beginning to see now with the Islamic awakening as well. Yes. It's a very, very dangerous time. Indeed. Where the powers tend to manipulate what the passions of the people.
Indeed.
But, of course, the clergy, you know, were still at the forefront to try and restore those rights. And, you know, the British hijacked it, being the power of the time, hijacks it. And then we get to see by 1920, you know, this, you know, commander in the Iranian army under the Qajar dynasty, Reza Khan, who seems to be the prime candidate for the British.
A Cossack,
yeah,
private,
exactly.
In reality,
yes, he was a very low-ranking guy, but the British had a talent for finding such people, and they found that he was, you know, fit to the purpose of trying to dismantle the Islamic character of Iran. And this is the background we are talking about here. Indeed. In terms of the clergy's resistance to this individual, as well as to the coup, basically, which brought Reza Khan to power.
Indeed, you see, the main important thing that we see in this kind of build-up that you're doing,
yes,
is that whilst Imam Khomeini is observing these changes, he's not ignoring the fact that he too needs to be Islamically and religiously educated to elevate himself to be a confrontation to these people.
No.
You know, he never confronted them in a non-religious way.
No.
All his arguments were purely religiously dominated confrontations. You know, in fact, from the age when he went to the Hoza to about 1962, he's purely developing his Islamic academic status in the community.
Exactly.
Within the ulema ranking, he's getting identified as a competent alimuddin.
Exactly.
You know, when Ayatollah Hayri takes the madrasa from Iraq to Qom, Ayatollah Hayri actually invites Imam Khomeini over because he knows that Imam Khomeini is a very learned youngster of that age, of that time.
I mean, this is a thing we have to point out to our listeners, of course, that Imam Khomeini, is not, we're not building up Imam Khomeini in a character in terms of, you know, some kind of historical context. We're doing it on the fact that, you know, he has merit right from the beginning.
Indeed, and his merits are seen by the fact that, as you pointed out in our last session, that Imam Khomeini, not only did he become an expert in religious fields, but he also became experts in other areas of learning.
Yes, absolutely.
You know, he was his depth of understanding of Eastern and Western philosophy was far beyond.
That's right.
And you see, what is really interesting, a lot of people put Imam Khomeini's understanding at that time as being one of pure mysticism and Irfani understanding. Or he doesn't neglect the fact that he has developed in a mystical environment of mysticism because he had some very learned scholars of Irfan.
Well, I mean, we have to point out to the fact to our listeners that, you know, Islamic studies is a very comprehensive form of study. I mean, if you go to the Hawza, you are required to learn different sciences, you know, from, hadith sciences to Quranic sciences, to learning about fiqh, about jurisprudence. You know, you're also required to learn, as you say, about Irfan. And Imam Khomeini spent 6 years of his life studying those aspects.
Yeah, but what I'm trying to bring home in this point is that he did not just become a hermit.
No, that's right. No,
that,
no,
What he did quite, with his Islamic awareness, because point. This is very yes. important to understand,
yeah, yeah,
that
yeah.
at the moment, the world is trying to create a vacuum of that's religious right. practitioners.
Yeah. You know, we're talking like the Sufis, for
exactly,
example. Like, it's not
it's,
like
it's,
that.
It's yeah. ideal that you do become religious and sit in one corner and practice your own religion.
Right.
Imam Khomeini did not extrapolate that from his learnings.
No.
What he decided was that he was going to build himself, elevate him towards God, but not on his own. He was going to elevate his society to take with him.
Well, he points out something that's very, very important for the Muslim Ummah in terms of what you're saying there, because he points out the fact that if you want true success in terms of guiding the Ummah, you know, to take the real, because we are really talking about taking the mantle of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his whole family. Because, of course, in this day and age, we are in the age of the occultation. We don't have an infallible to guide the Imam. So we have to have, as Imam Khomeini says, we have to have something in between that we have gained from our infallible Imams to guide the Ummah at all times and at all in all situations. And what you're pointing out is such a fundamental and basic point in Islam, which, you know, as you say, the Imam Khomeini embodies in a sense in his personality and his character, that he is saying that, you know, we've got to do away with the ego. And everything must be for Allah's sake. And
indeed,
if you do that, you're going to find the formula for success in guiding the Ummah, because he's got no personal ambition whatsoever.
And you see, this is why this, he becomes really the subject of this ayat as
yes,
well.
Yes.
That, you know, whilst the people are the ayat is saying, don't forget, you will be called on that day with your Imam.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
he's saying, look, Imam Khomeini is saying if a Muslim leadership wants to be close to God, it should be such that he will be counted in this ayat and people would be dashing with him to be counted with him on the Day of Judgment.
Exactly.
You
exactly.
see, so in other words, the aspiration. I mean, we have an ayat in the Quran which we read in the Qunut of every Salat. We say, "Rabbana atina fid dunya hasana wa fil akhirati hasana." In the sense that we're saying, "Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, grant me the goodness in this world and the goodness in the hereafter." So, you know, we're not telling people just become a hermit and sit in the corner and just do om, you know, and pray that the idols of shaitaniyat will elevate us to the day of judgment.
Because in that hasana, we are also talking about this adherence to the walaya.
Indeed. And you see, what Imam Khomeini has done in his passing of time till 63, right. particularly 1963, is that he's observing the things which are destroying the hasana of the community.
Yes.
You look at what Imam Khomeini had observed in his time.
Yes.
He was observing that certain changes in the constitution which were going to destroy the pure nature of the Muslim community.
Exactly.
One of the things that the Shah was trying to promote was that he was going to allow non-Muslims to enter politics and make Muslim decisions without even taking an oath on the Quran. Without
Absolutely.
Taking an oath on any religious book. In other words, total disobedience
total
to the Creator.
Total blasphemies in terms of religion.
And the other thing which really jolted Imam Khomeini's attitude towards the Shah was that they were about to pass, in fact, they were in the process of passing the law, and the law was enforced for a while, that, you know, if an American murdered anybody in England or in Iran. That person would not be judged under Iranian laws. He would be taken to America and judged under American law.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's that total decapitation of Islamic values, distortion and total abortion or removal of that which
I mean, this is what we have to point out to our listeners, that the background in which, you know, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, may God bless him, you know, is acquiring his Islamic knowledge, supporting the Hawza, supporting the leadership of the, and I was thinking of Ayatollah Mudarris, because Ayatollah Mudarris was at the forefront of the resistance against Reza Khan's blasphemies
and
in the
martyred
face of Sharia.
For it.
Yeah, he was martyred, yes, of course, he was martyred at the end. But, you know, this is what we are pointing out, that, you know, Imam Khomeini is not doing something out of the blue here.
Indeed,
he's doing it in a context in which there is great leadership in amongst the Shia who are at the forefront of the resistance to what Reza Khan was doing.
And you see, the educational system was being destroyed.
Destroying.
Mixed
was
education
being
was being
he
generated.
Said, namaz was banned.
Yes.
The Holy Quran could no longer be studied in school.
Hijab was destroyed.
Hijab had to be removed. Things like this. I mean, in a Muslim country, in an Islamic country, I mean, for centuries, you know, you have you know, the Shia tradition that was established, you know, during the time of the Safavids. And he's removing all that.
Yeah, but you see that what was happening is that these lawmakers were looking at all these in the same perspective as Atatürk was in Turkey.
That's right. Yes,
they were trying to look at it in a kind of changing world, improving society. But in reality, the aspirations were to destroy the Islamic nature of the society.
Exactly. I mean, this is what the British and the Russians were looking
for. And you see, Imam Khomeini, in his depth of Islam that he understood, he was able to say you can have advancement in Islamic society without abandoning Islamic values. That is what he stood for ultimately when he...
That's right.
When the confrontation... Because you see, you've got to remember again, bringing back home, the fact that Imam Khomeini was really well read in Islamic concepts.
That's right.
So well read that he was able to articulate those theories into a practical form for the public in the early kind of mid late 20th century, you know, 1960s, 1970s. He was articulating all those religious values that he had put into him from the Hausa.
That's right. I mean, he really was he was a murja taqlid, an expert in his own right. By the 1940s, there's works that are coming out from him. You know, he's writing books on, you know, the rituals of prayer, which is a more mystical type of book. He's writing the traditions of Imam Raza. He's restoring and commenting on those aspects. And you know, by the 1940s, he's really an expert in his own right. But he's still under the stewardship of Ayatollah Borojerdi, because while he is the man who is at the head of the Hausa system, you know, he's still the student.
And you see, until 1962, early 1963, Imam Khomeini is just putting himself to teaching and experiencing. Because again, with Ayatollah Borojerdi's position, Imam Khomeini did not stop giving his lectures in Fezziye, for example.
That's right.
You know, against Shah's position, and thereby not confronting Ayatollah Borojerdi, but in fact complimenting the strength of the ulema.
That's
He would not say, even in his speeches, he would say Shah this, Shah that. He wouldn't say Ayatollah Borojerdi, why aren't you confronting?
No. He would say statements like, "I kiss the hands of the clergy."
Yes.
Because he's supporting them all the way, because that was what needed to be done.
Indeed.
Because they were flying in the face of, as you say, no prayer, no hijab. And even saying that the morning ceremonies of Ashura were going to be stopped or banned, which, you know, Ayatollah Mordaris made a huge demonstration in Qom in the face of that, and that was reversed. You know, they couldn't implement those things, you know, which were, you know, in the deep psyche of the people. You know, that really, you know, when you say things like that, you know, no matter how bad a Shia is, you know, he will never, ever say that, you know, I will not go to, you know, the morning ceremonies of Ashura. You know, it's just absolutely impossible. It's so deeply ingrained that it just cannot happen. But as I say...
And then you see, what we have to understand is these people were themselves also Shias who were trying to do this.
Yeah.
You know, the Shah claimed to be a Shia. What Imam Khomeini tried to bring home to people is that you cannot claim to be a Shia and be confronting Shia values.
Exactly.
And
I mean, this was the
what is really
the facet that they were trying to confront.
Ashura in 1963, the year when it's interesting, because Imam Khomeini gives a very important speech against the Shah, and he compares the Shah to Yazid.
Yes, yes,
and quite clearly telling people that he's a Yazid of the time, because he's annihilating Islamic values, yet hypocritically calling himself a Muslim.
Yeah.
You see, and all these things really mounted up in introducing Imam Khomeini to the general public and making them realize that as a religious guide, he also has the want to develop the social political fabric of the Shia community.
That's right.
You know, he's not just purely. You know, it's a very interesting statement made by Imam Khomeini in certain discussions relating to political aspirations. He said the Western politics has endeavored to close off the religious participants in society's activities. By saying that you're a religious entity, if you come into social, political decision-making process, you're going to spoil your religiousness, stay in the mosque. That one area, kind of looking at the spirituality of a leader.
Well, this is something... Well, in one sense, if we want to be fair here, we want to say that the West will definitely do this as a matter of policy, because they've had a whole history and a whole, since the days of the Enlightenment, a whole philosophy that they have followed through.
That religion and politics should be separate.
It has to be separate in order for their societies to advance. But of course, in the Islamic context, that is completely wrong.
Indeed it is. Because you see, even in their concept is wrong. Mm. Because what they're implying is that a politician, can sit and lie to his back teeth and not expect to be penalized because he's a politician. Politics demands lying. This is what the implications
are. That's right, and that's also wrong.
If spirituality comes into the system, you demand that spirituality must also lie.
That's right.
The extension of the primus is this. Mm. But spirituality, when it comes to the system, it's meant to be an annihilator of these liars.
Exactly.
And that's what Imam Khomeini articulated. And that's why you see throughout the movements of the ulema, you've got the tobacco movement by Ayatollah Shirazi, for example.
Ayatollah Shirazi,
and he too is taking this on that, you know, the wealth of the Muslim ummah is being taken away by people who are lying to their back teeth that they're representing Islam.
Well, to be honest, Sayyid, I mean, the point is being, you know, very strongly made here that this is what the imperial powers were afraid of. They're afraid of this kind of clergy who has this kind of respect and honor in the hearts of the people, that when, you know, as you say, like Ayatollah Shirazi can turn around and say in a matter of one night that you stop buying tobacco.
Yeah.
Don't smoke it. And all the hookahs that they used to do and they used to use, or the pipes that we're using, were chucked out into the street. So there we are. I mean, it was this kind of power that they had over the Muslim masses which frightens the imperial powers.
In fact, you see, this is what the British did. Mm. If we look at just a little bit, sidetrack a little bit from and look at the history at that time.
Yes, please do.
That, you know, one of the things that the British Foreign Ministry was investing in was on the Wahhabi movement at that same time.
That's right. That was in parallel,
exactly,
as we are talking.
To be a kind of confrontation to the logical Islam that the Shiite and Imam Khomeini's teachings were from the Hauza.
Yeah.
In the future going to show. Mm. Because the Wahhabi movement was a total downtrodden, ignorant batch of people who came out representing a belief of ideological incompetence, but really an example of what Islam should be.
Mm.
You know, idiots who could not do anything other than burn schools for girls, deprive women from education, taking the whole intellectual thinking of Islam down toward the village level.
Absolutely right, Sayyid. And the thing is that, you know, of course, with this parallel movement which was going on, and, you know, again, the British had the talent for finding these particular people in Najd, which is now known as Ibn Saud, but these particular grouping of people, the main focus of the British policy was to narrow this Islam, you know, to take out the very principles which make the Islamic Ummah dynamic and active and, you know, progressive.
And the Hauza teaching created that progression.
Sure.
As I said, through Ayatollah Mudarris, as you pointed out, through Ayatollah Shirazi, through Ayatollah Mirza Shirazi, who was the latter person who declared confrontation with the British forces and the British guard, then Imam Khomeini. So, you know, you could see a continuous development.
Thank you for that, Sayyid, honestly. At this moment in time, listeners, you know, we're getting to the stage where we're talking about the dynamism and the progressiveness of, you know, the movement, particularly here by the Hauza. But we'll discuss this in further depth in the next program. So thank you very much for listening today. May the peace and blessings and mercy of Allah be upon you all. Thank you and goodbye.
the light.
The Swedish city of Stockholm has launched its 31st annual Christmas competition of baking gingerbread.
There is a limited in space, so it's 40 centimeters by 40 centimeters, and everything you build, all the material, need to be eatable. So you can build with different things, gingerbread, of course, but also candies and other things, but you need to be able to eat it. So that's one of the rules as well.
Each year, the Gingerbread House competition, hosted by ArcDesk Museum of Architecture and Design, has a theme for the designs. This year's theme is Together, attracting various interpretations of the topic. So far, the entries have included the Titanic, the famous coffee shop from the American TV show Friends, an igloo, and the Berlin Wall, all entirely edible. The event, which has been running for 31 years, is designed for all kinds of creators, such as children, young people, adults, amateurs, and professionals. The Tasty Exhibition runs until January the 5th. A Palestinian teacher has developed an assistant for himself nicknamed Mr. Robot, bringing joy to the children of a school in Gaza. Mr. Robot teaches the children of Al-Basma School about electric circuits and helps them memorize their lessons. Mr. Robot moves freely in the classroom, speaking Arabic to students and communicating with them as a friend. The teacher creating it says the aim was to stimulate creativity and innovation in his classroom.
Mr. Robot, as his name suggests, is the teacher's assistant and not his replacement. He assists in the education process by asking questions and giving answers, greeting students and interacting with them in all aspects of a class.
The teacher says at first students reacted to it in a strange way, but later on they said it was like a dream come true for them. Local engineers say the robot is the first of its kind in the Gaza Strip, where electrical tools and components are scarce.
Artificial intelligence has found its way into several aspects of our lives. Now, a French research team is working on a project to provide fishermen with intelligent trawls that could help them sort out fishes before they are brought to the boats.
The objective of the project is to try to provide a support tool for fishermen, because at the moment, when they put their fishing gear in the water, a trawl net is like a large net. It is towed behind the vessel for several hours without having knowledge of what enters the trawl net in real time. Namely, is it species that are targeted by the fishermen or not targeted?
The trawl head has a camera that can capture footage underwater, which is then analyzed by a microcomputer using artificial intelligence. If targeted fishes are detected, the trawl will switch to fishing mode. But when there are no targeted species, it will switch back to flight mode to avoid having an impact on the seabed. Another feature of this technology is to identify and classify pelagic species. For instance, horse mackerel can be displayed in blue on the screen, while the sardines are shown in pink. If you enjoy nighttime adventures, then this park in Paris is just for you. Decorated with colorful lighting, the venue gives you a real feeling of life-size sculptures depicting dinosaurs and other prehistoric animals. In this exhibition, dubbed Evolution on a Path of Lights, visitors can walk through tunnels formed by some of the sculptors. They are made of paper, steel, and lights. More than 100 sculptors light up like lanterns across the park. These include well-known favorites of kids, such as Triceratops and T-Rex. Some huge lanterns also represent insects and vertebrates that walked on the planet millions of years ago. The exhibition's director says the goal is to raise awareness and educate the public about biodiversity in the past and present.
in Thailand, monkeys climbing on piles of fruits and vegetables in central Thailand. It is not due to a mess, though. It is actually an annual event called the Monkey Festival in Lopburi Province. The long-tailed monkeys, known as macaques, feast on 2 tons of